two divers decide to dive one of the most dangerous caves in the world. One diver's body is recovered 10 years later, and the other's takes almost 21 years to recover after three failed attempts and a chance encounter. This is the story of Kent Maupin, Mark Brashear, and the attempt to recover their bodies from Jacob's Well in Hays County, Texas. Jacob's Well is a freshwater spring that was first recorded around 1850. Measuring 12 foot in diameter at the surface of the well, it descends to 140 feet at its deepest recorded point and extends 4,300 feet to its furthest recorded point. The cool, clear water in Jacob's Well rises up from the Trinity Aquifer. The surface of the spring effectively sits below the surrounding groundwater level. That means water gets pushed up out of the spring by the weight of the surrounding water table. In 1924, the flow rate up into the spring was measured at 22 cubic feet per second. For the first time in the year 2000, the well stopped flowing. Since then, it's stopped flowing four times, with the most recent time in July 2022. This happens as groundwater levels drop, and so there's no water pressure to create the rising flow into the spring. The lower flow rate makes it easier for divers to enter the cave system because they don't have to fight their way against a current. It's not a safe cave system to enter. While cave diving has its inherent dangers, the three things that make Jacob's Well more dangerous are the flow of water that a diver has to work against on their way in, the narrow openings between chambers, which are often sloping downwards, and unstable gravel that can fill those already narrow passageways. One of these restrictions is called the birth canal at around 70 feet deep. After divers descend a gravel slope, they have to push their way through an opening that can be as narrow as 15 inches, depending on how much gravel has made its way down the slope. The slope opens into a wider chamber. Often divers have to dig their way through the gravel, then push their equipment through the channel ahead of them and into the chamber. Once through this narrow channel, divers are berthed into the next chamber. Over the years, as many as 9 diving fatalities have been recorded in Jacob's Well. There are possibly more unrecorded deaths. Today, you need a permit to dive the cave system. On the 9th of September 1979, two divers arrive at Jacob's Well intent on diving the cave system. They're in a group of around 20 people, but these two want to go into the cave before the larger group can disturb the sediment in the cave. At 23:30 on the evening they arrive, they enter the water while most others are setting up camp. Kent Maupin and Mark Brashear are experienced divers in their early 20s. Kent is an assistant instructor. He's been diving since he was 12. They don't just want to dive the cave first, they want to go all the way to the last recorded chamber, which has a deadly history. Mark and Kent descend down the first chamber where the spring opens to the surface. It's a 30-foot drop to a bedrock platform where they then turn to move sideways into the next chamber. Chamber 2 is a long sloping chamber. Towards the bottom of Chamber 2 is a narrowing passage into Chamber 3 called the birth canal at around 75 feet deep. After traversing the birth canal into Chamber 3, Kent and Mark find a few other divers exploring what everyone considers the last safe chamber in the cave system. Mark and Kent have their sights set on a prize they know has already claimed the lives of 4 other divers. Chamber 4. They descend the sloping gravel floor to the entrance of Chamber 4 at around 90 feet deep. This is bordering on the depth that divers will start to experience nitrogen narcosis. Nitrogen narcosis is the neurological effect from breathing nitrogen under pressure. It's caused by nitrogen molecules in your breathing gas that are compressed together under pressure that then restrict the flow of neurons in the synapses of the brain. Divers experience this like drinking martinis. The deeper you go, the more martinis. Kent takes off his scuba gear, turns around, and backs himself into the tunnel that leads into Chamber 4. Mark copies and follows. Joe Moy is in Chamber 3 and sees Mark back his way into the tunnel with only one light and no cave reel. He swims over and flashes his light at Mark in an attempt to catch his attention and question the judgment of this move. In what I would consider tunnel vision, Mark doesn't even look up. He simply backs into the tunnel and neither Kent nor Mark are seen again. Joe Moy is shocked at what he's just seen. He waits as long as his air supply will allow, then he leaves one of his torches at the entrance to the fourth chamber, hoping that the two divers will see the light. And then he turns around and heads back out of the cave to notify other divers. While he makes his ascent, Joe struggles with what he's just seen. He knows he's going to the surface to organize a search. In his heart, he hopes it's a rescue. In his head, he knows it's a body recovery. Joe gets to the surface and lets the other divers know what has happened. A call goes out to local law enforcement. Paul Battaglia is a police officer and cave diver. At the police station, he gets the call to organize a rescue. An hour after the first call, Paul Battaglia arrives at Don Dibble's house. Dibble is a former Navy diver, cave diving expert, a diving instructor, owner of the local dive shop, and along with Battaglia, a member of the Hays County Volunteer Body Recovery Unit. Dibble and Battaglia discuss how a rescue will proceed. They discuss this as a rescue, but they know it's a body recovery. The plan to recover a body will vary only slightly from a rescue, and so they set their plan in motion. They call other members of the recovery unit, drive to Dibble's dive shop to collect equipment, and make their way to Jacob's Well about 15 minutes from the dive shop. When they arrive, it's still dark. The group from Pasadena have been in the water searching for the two lost divers. They report to Dibble that they haven't been able to recover Kent and Mark, and they've searched throughout the cave system. They're certain the two divers are buried inside Chamber 4 because one of the divers believes he saw equipment buried under gravel slide in the passage leading down into Chamber 4. This diver, who isn't named in any reports I can find, is said to have made two 90-minute dives back to back, spotted the bodies, and then went home to rest, where he developed decompression sickness and had to go into a recompression chamber for treatment. This demonstrates one of the biggest problems in any rescue. When divers get into trouble, it's usually because they themselves are pushing the safety envelope inside an extreme environment. Rescuers are then put in a position where they themselves have to push the envelope even further. And to make matters worse, they can feel the pressure of a ticking clock, which usually results in poor judgment. Dive planning tables are used to work out how long a diver can stay at a certain depth, and then how long they need to stay out of the water between dives. You can stay at 140 feet for only 8 minutes before the dive becomes a decompression dive, where you have to make safety stops during your ascent. You then need to stay out of the water for no less than 1.5 hours before you can go down for another 8-minute dive. So this diver did two decompression dives with no interval between them so that he could try and save lives, and in the process he got decompression sickness. It's still dark, and Don's first thought is to wait until daylight. His experience recovering ex-persons is that they're normally prepared to wait until sunrise. He refers to dead bodies as ex-persons, as a way to disassociate from the reality of dealing with people who are no longer alive, a coping mechanism he's developed over the years in body recovery. But it's just as dark inside the cave as it is at night, and so he sends two divers into the water to assess the situation. They return to the surface and let Don know that it won't be a simple recovery. They can't see the bodies, but they assume they're buried under gravel in the passageway sloping into Chamber 4. They're quite unsettled by the idea of trying to pull the bodies out when they can see that more gravel can quite easily slide down the slope and bury any rescuer digging into the narrow passageway. At 10 a.m, Don sends two more divers in. They start to remove some rock and gravel at the entrance to Chamber 4. Their hope is to dig out a channel so they can get into the next chamber. But any rocks they remove are quickly replaced by more gravel. Don decides to go in himself to assess the situation. He and a game warden take a few extra stage tanks, which they leave at 25 feet and 75 feet for their return journey. Don gets to the entrance of the chamber at 140 feet deep. The passage tapers off between the roof and the gravel. He decides to squeeze in slightly to try and sight the back of the passageway. He gets shoulder deep when gravel slides in from behind, trapping him in much the same way as the two divers whose bodies he's searching for. Don's breathing accelerates and his heart starts to pound. He knows instantly he's in trouble, but in a calm way that only comes with experience, he tries to free himself. First, he tries to move his hands, but they're wedged tight. He can't even pull the line on the reel. Then he wriggles his body. More gravel slides in around him. Even though his head is saying stay calm, he's starting to panic. He starts to writhe and twist to get free. He gulps in air and swallows hard. And then to his surprise and relief, the gravel lets go. It slides in underneath him and he's able to make his way back out the passageway. But he's gulped and spluttered so much air that his tanks are empty. Slightly dazed, his buddy jams his spare regulator into Don's mouth and starts to take him back up through the chambers. On the other side of the birth canal is a spare cylinder. Don needs to get there quick, but the air he swallowed is now expanding in his stomach. Air is compressed under the pressure of the water. As an air bubble ascends, it expands. So the small amount of air Don swallowed is now expanding. From 140 feet to the surface, the air will expand to 5 times its volume when he swallowed it. At the surface, Don's stomach has expanded so much he looks like he's pregnant. He's taken to a recompression chamber. The treatment does nothing to relieve his pain. Don's transferred to another hospital where an X-ray shows his stomach has ruptured and air has filled the cavity in his stomach. His doctor describes the operation like cutting into a basketball which instantly deflates. Don's hospital bill left him $8,000 in debt because his insurance had lapsed. In the weeks that followed, the diving community rallied to raise the funds to help Don out. Back at Jacob's Well, the recovery operations have progressed with another leader in the diving community. Don Broad has a history with Jacob's Well. After seeing divers get into trouble, Broad negotiated with the owner of the land to allow him to manage the site. Broad started charging an entrance fee which he used to cover the costs of regulating access to the well. Through this process, he could make sure that divers had the right training and experience to dive in such a challenging environment. But other dive centers and instructors didn't like paying an entrance fee to the site where they previously had free access. Complaints mounted to the owner of the land, who then let the contract expire and Broad no longer had the ability to regulate safety standards at the well. Now Broad is back to help recover the bodies of 2 divers, and Broad knows this would have been prevented had he still been in control. He puts his frustration aside so he can help recover the bodies of these 2 young men. Broad inspects the site that he knows well. He lays out a plan to remove the gravel by filling net bags and floating them out with lift bags. They will start at the top of the slope and work their way down, ensuring there's no gravel higher up the slope to slide down and replace the gravel they dig out from the passageway. He lets the families and authorities know this will take many weeks, even months of work to excavate the site. Kent and Mark's parents have been notified and they arrive at the well. Kent's dad is overwhelmed by the support from the diving community, who are rallying to try and find their son's bodies. A local bank creates a fund and the community starts to donate the money needed to support the logistics of recovering Kent and Mark. The families and authorities now have a daunting task to choose who has the best plan to recover their loved ones. 2 divers are dead and missing. 1 recreational diver has already had decompression sickness. Another professional search and rescue diver has had a ruptured stomach, and yet another cave expert has an ambitious plan to excavate the site by hand over a number of months. Grief-stricken and perhaps desperate to recover the bodies of their loved ones as quickly as possible, along with the authorities who want a quick fix, they look for an alternative option. They find this in a commercial diving outfit, Schaefer Diving Company from Freeport. The owner of the company, Lewis Schaefer, tells reporters, "Yeah, we'll get them out." He trucks in a recompression chamber, several compressors, and gravel pumping equipment. The cost of the operation starts with $5,000 to get the equipment in and runs at $2,500 a day. Lewis expects it to take 2 or 3 days. He and his team set up and start pumping out dirt and gravel from the passageway. The commercial divers use a surface air supply system, which means they have an umbilical that provides air from compressors at the surface and 2-way communication. Large rocks are put in burlap bags and pulled out with ropes, guided by volunteer divers, while gravel is pumped out using a long pipe that sucks up the gravel like a large vacuum cleaner. For several days, the routine of pumping out sand and gravel continues. On a number of occasions, the commercial divers descend in the morning to find more gravel has settled into the passageway they had cleared the previous days. Almost a week into the operation, one of the divers is pinned in a gravel slide, but his colleagues are able to dig him out quickly, although this unsettles the divers. A few more days of digging and they're able to get a camera some way into the passageway. A group of people inspect the recording and think they can make out a metal tank, but it's not clear enough to be certain. The next day, they carry on digging until one of the divers is able to squeeze almost all the way through. He reports that he can see some of the chamber, but can't go far enough to see the whole chamber. There are two large boulders and several tons of gravel that will need to be removed. Following that, Lewis Schaefer's right-hand man, Bill Wright, who's in charge of the dive site, gives a press conference to say they've run out of money. They aren't diving for free and someone needs to pay their bills. Bill and his men hole up in a local hotel room and wait the next few days until finally Pasadena's state senator confirms he will underwrite the company's bills to date, and then Lewis Schaefer says he will donate the company's time from there on. The divers go back to the site after several days of political posturing, only to discover that the entire passageway is once again engulfed in gravel. A second dive company is called in to give their opinion, and they all come to the same conclusion. There is simply no way to safely and economically excavate all the gravel from inside Jacob's Well in a way that will allow them to get inside Chamber 4 to search for the bodies of Kent and Mark. Kent's dad is grateful that so many people have put their lives at risk to help recover their son's bodies, but he's also concerned that more people might be injured or even die if they continue to push further into Chamber 4. 12 days after the two divers went missing, the search is called off. Don Dibble recovers from his burst stomach and returns to dive Jacob's Well with a group of friends. They set about cementing a grate into place that would prevent any divers going further than the birth canal. Some months later, Dibble returns only to find his grate has been removed and a note left in place to say, "You can't keep us out." 21 years after Kent Maupin went into Jacob's Well, his remains were finally recovered in a chance encounter with a group of geologists mapping the cave system. His parents found out when a reporter called them for a comment.